Right, continuing in Lex Rex, in question 30 of that study by Rutherford, he asks whether our consciences are bound by God to passive obedience. He needs to address this idea of passive obedience because we see it in the life of Christ. And Christ's passive obedience was him willingly subjecting himself to the unlawfulness of being put to death on the cross. He had active obedience, and his active obedience was in obeying everything that God had laid out. And then there was passive obedience where he subjected himself to the persecution and the ill treatment and finally the suffering and death on the cross. Jesus didn't resist the lawless actions perpetrated against himself by the authorities in Jerusalem. And so Rutherford says, royalists, and we'll come back to this point as well, but royalists make much of 1 Peter 2 verse 18, where it says, servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. The assumption of the verse is that one ought to bow to the lawful chastisement of good masters, but also to submit to the undeserved chastisement of bad masters. And thus the royalists, they argue that since we are to endure the suffering to those masters who were evil, how much more shouldn't we patiently and without resistance suffer under kings? And that's what he means by passive obedience, to endure that injustice. So Rutherford wants to try and make a point now, and he says that these verses speak nothing about resistance. That is, it doesn't touch on the topic and therefore can't be appealed to as support for the royalist's position. He says, patient suffering of wicked men and violent resisting are not incompatible. So patient endurance of suffering and violent resistance of wicked men are not incompatible. He wants to suggest to us that they can be found in the same instant. He says that the royalist's argument has no substance, and it goes like this. This is him telling us what the royalists are arguing. Since servants are to suffer unjust wounds and buffeting from wicked masters, and that they are to bear it patiently, therefore servants are bound in their consciences to non-resistance. Rutherford wants to argue that Scripture clearly shows that the church is to bear with patience within the Lord's indignation due to her sin and to suffer wicked enemies. However, this in no way meant that God's people were obliged to non-resistance and were not allowed to fight against such enemies. The only time, Rutherford adds, that God's people are not to resist their enemies is when they have a specific command from God telling them not to, as when Babylon came against Judah. So there you had God bringing Babylon in judgment against Judah, and then he had a positive command, a specific word brought by Jeremiah the prophet saying you are not allowed to resist in this instance. You should bow and humble to Babylon. And so Rutherford's argument is that God's people are to resist by fighting and also to endure patiently the indignation of the Lord unless there's some specific command coming. Which would mean in our days it's without the prophet, you're not going to get that specific command. You can debate that point. Maybe there is a command that Rutherford is missing. What is a positive command from the Lord? So obviously in this situation it was the prophet's words, Jeremiah. And so in that sense, it kind of says, okay, how does that make us look at our lives now in the United States? We could have, in all truthfulness, we could agree together that yes, God is raising up ISIS to be a serious challenge and a threat to the United States. And we could all agree that that is the case. But Rutherford's point is this, is yes, it might very well be. And God might be disciplining you. And you've got to endure that suffering and all that it brings patiently, yet that does not mean there is no place for resistance. That's how I understand what his point on that thing. Unless we had a word brought to us to say, no, you are not allowed to resist in this instance. Because the rest of Scripture, from Rutherford's perspective, is saying that that is the natural automatic thing of defending yourself, upholding and providing for those who are yours, therefore you resist unless you have a specific command. So the principle Rutherford is trying to establish at this stage is the command to patient endurance of wrong. But he says that this does not automatically exclude resistance. He says that David bore the discipline of the Lord patiently when Absalom rose up against him and took the kingdom. As David was fleeing from Jerusalem, And the ark was taken from the temple and was carried along and brought along with David's exodus. We read in 2 Samuel 15, verses 25 and 26, "Then the king said to Zadok, 'Carry the ark of God back to the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and show me both it and his dwelling place. But if he says thus, "I have no delight in you," here I am, let him do to me as seems good to him." So here David, according to Rutherford, is manifesting that patience in the suffering. Although he's fleeing from his capital, although he's on the run, he's enduring it with patience. This is from the Lord's hand. And again in 2 Samuel 16, verse 10, when David was leaving, if you remember the more common story, which Shimei was coming along, he hated David, and he was cursing David all the while and calling all kinds of names, and David's mighty men riding next to him were finding it hard to endure this, and they said, "Can't one of us go across there and cut the head off that dog?" And David said, "No, I don't think so, because I believe God is doing this at this stage, and I'm going to endure this patiently. So don't touch him and leave him alone." So Rutherford says that when the children of Israel were attacked by different groups while wandering in the wilderness, you have the Ammonites and the Moabites, this was the Lord testing them, according to Deuteronomy 8:16, where God said, "I tested you in the wilderness. I was testing you, and all these different things that came across your path, including these attacks," Rutherford suggests, "these were tests. Nevertheless, Israel was defending themselves at the same time." So, at the same time, I think David, although he was saying, "This is from the Lord, and he's testing my patience," and he received this stuff patiently, he nevertheless dispatched Joab and the army to go and fight against Absalom and to deal with the enemy. So Rutherford says, "One act of grace and virtue is not contrary to another. Resistance is in the children of God an innocent act of self-preservation, as is patient suffering, and therefore they may well subsist in one." They might be in the same situation and the same person. As we receive it patiently, he says, dealing here with your hearts, how do we respond should we suddenly be engulfed in a mass outbreak of suicide terror? How do we as a people respond? He's saying patiently, but you also resist. Rutherford then quotes in support of this 1 Chronicles 12:18, where Amasai said by the Spirit of the Lord to David and his men who were resisting King Saul, "Peace, peace to you, and peace to your helpers, for your God helps you." And so David is saying, but this is in the context, 1 Chronicles 12:18. This is in the context of David and his group resisting the king. So Yahweh, when David was fleeing from King Saul, he had this whole group of men joining with him, and they were formed this military group that were, in a sense, standing against the king, but from a distance. And here he's saying, here's a word spoken by the Lord saying, indeed, this is good, what these people are supporting you. God is blessing you. So Rutherford's argument, at least, is that 1 Peter 2 verse 18 says nothing about violent resisting. So he's not saying to the slaves, you're not allowed to resist, you're not allowed to do anything. Either positively or negatively, that verse is not saying you can or you can't. Rather, what is forbidden is revenge for resisting and repaying one wrong with another. This verse is in line with Christ's example, who when he was reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not. 1 Peter 2 verse 23. Thus Rutherford concludes that the royalist argument with respect to this verse in 1 Peter is a fallacy. They've got it wrong, and using that as an argument against his position of resisting. So Rutherford then spends quite some time on showing how foolish it would be to use Christ's example as the standard to be followed, since his example was unique, and the command to do what he did was imposed upon him by the Eternal Father. So many people say, well, what did Jesus do? Jesus didn't do that. When he was arrested in the garden, when he was tried before Pilate, he didn't even answer. He didn't even try to defend himself. He even said, my guys are not coming to try and get me out. And so they take that and they say, this is the example. And Rutherford says, well, this would just create chaos. Because if we take that as an example, and then he just goes through for a long time, which I didn't want to bring out all his points, because it would have taken us too long. He says, but if Christ's example was to be followed, then it would be wrong to flee from the unjust persecution, since Jesus didn't. The saints, in fact, would need to go to the place where they knew they would be apprehended by the unjust, because that's what Jesus did. He knew he was going to be apprehended, and he went, let's go there, and that's where he was taken. And he goes through a number of other things, like that, to say, if this is our example of what we should do, then we need to follow it in the details. According to Rutherford, there are only two conditions where God morally commands, or his law commands, suffering formally as suffering. He says Christ's passive obedience is the first, and the second is when his followers are told to deny Christ's truth and his name or suffer death. And at that point you're saying, well, I can't do that. And Christ was specific, unique calling, where he was told, you're going to lay down your life for the sacrifice, and so he did that. But he says that's unique. And then if we're in such a situation where we have to deny Christ, then we choose suffering. He says, 1 Peter 2:18 teaches that when the servant is unjustly buffeted, he is not to buffet his master in return, but to bear this patiently as Christ did, who did not revile again. He is to do this not because the verse condemns resistance in self-defense, but because buffeting again is re-offending, not defending. Defending is formally warding off a blow or a stroke. You defend yourself. Buffeting is re-offending. You're throwing back garbage at a different time or in a different way when the offending is not in, or the buffeting is not in process. So if my neighbor comes to kill me and I cannot save myself by fighting, then I can kill rather than be killed. However, if I kill him out of malice and hatred in the act of defending, then this becomes murder. Yet the offending of another, necessitated from the sole purpose of self-defense, is nothing other than an innocent act of self-defense. So if the offense that I'm bringing is immediately stopping a blow, self-defense, if I'm defending myself and I lose my temper and my defense now becomes aggressive and I kill him, he's saying that's culpable. So in other words, if David with his men had killed any of Saul's men in a set battle, David and his men, only intending self-defense, the war on David's part was a mere defensive war. So he continues, he says, though if we are given a deadly wound, it's an interesting idea, he says, if we're given a deadly wound by someone, and we know we're about to die, and at that point we react and we kill them, after we are mortally wounded, and since we are but a private person, this cannot be regarded as an act of self-defense. Now obviously that would have to be, I would say, you have to qualify that in the context of you're on your own out somewhere in the field. But even then you'd have to say, okay, where's this person going to? Are my family in danger? He's purely limiting it here. He's trying to deal with the personal motive of the person. So it can't be too restrictive in my feeling. We've got to realize that should this person have attacked me in my house and I'm mortally wounded and my family's all around, if I get a chance, I'm going to kill him before he has a chance to hurt anybody else. So, but I don't think Rutherford's trying to exclude that. I think he's just trying to keep it very narrow in the sense of what is your action and motive towards this person, as to what are your legal rights. Because once the thing has been done against you and he's no longer striking you, you are, because you're a private person, you no longer have the authority to take his life, unless I qualify the other extenuating circumstances. He says, any option we choose that is not used for preventing death must be an act of revenge. And so for a servant who is buffeted to buffet again, the second buffet, that means the servant's buffet, is not done in order to ward off the first buffet. It is not an act of self-defense. An act of self-defense must be an act destined only for self-defense. Okay, these are principles. I mean, obviously each circumstance is, and you're going to interpret it and try and apply it to how you read the circumstances. He says, a person is his brother's murderer who will not be his brother's keeper, where he may preserve his brother's life without loss to his own life. Likewise, when a person must preserve his own life and doesn't do what nature allows, which nature's law allows, namely to kill rather than be killed, he is guilty of self-murder because he is deficient in his duty of self-defense. So if you don't defend yourself, you're deficient in that duty. So Rutherford continues, he says, to kill or offend is not the nature of defensive war, but accidental to it. However, killing of cutthroats sent forth by the illegal commandment of the king may be intended as a mean and lawful mean of self-preservation. It's an interesting thought. They're saying defensive war's primary objective is not to kill. That's an accident of it. It's a something that flows out of it. He says, but cutthroats. Now, in his context, cutthroats were hired vagabonds that had no morals, they had no principles, they had one objective, and that was to come and murder you. It wasn't like we're going to do legal battle and warfare. And he's saying, that if you kill them, that's fine. So I'm not sure how to apply that, how to interpret it. I mean, is that comparable to a suicide bomber? to people who have no moral... You know, a war is usually fought on, I don't know, a basis of these guys are attacking these guys, this country. Cutthroats are just vagabonds. I'm not sure.
Is it mercenaries?
It's like mercenaries, right.
Hired guns. There's not a principle behind it other than they got paid to do it.
Correct.
He's saying that you may or may not.
You may at that point kill those. Although he's saying you're defending yourself when you go to war to defend yourself, your primary objective is not just to kill. I mean, obviously killing comes in and it becomes necessary and depending what the objective is, but it's the defense of war. But preemptive strike is there, so it's not... Once you start unpacking it, it becomes dynamic and changes. You've got to say, well, what are the principles here? But I think the principle is sound that he's saying, however it's going to be applied, and that is, that's not our objective. But I do believe in preemptive strike, and I think, in a sense, that's what he's talking about here, about cutthroats. Cutthroats, they don't sit down and wait for another day. They're just waiting for their opportunity to kill you. And so you're saying, okay, what? I'm just going to hope that I always beat them to the draw. So that's how I understand it. I might have misunderstood him. On page 148, Rutherford says something very pertinent about what would in our day be equivalent to gun control. He says, as therefore the king cannot take from one particular man the power of the sword for natural self-preservation, because it is the birthright of life, neither can the king take from a community and kingdom a power of rising in arms for their own defense. So he says, the right to bear arms is a birthright of life. And he says again in another, a little bit later on the same idea, to denounce the people armor because they may abuse the prince is to expose them to violence and oppression, and this unjustly. For one king may more easily abuse armor than all the people. One man may more easily fail than a community. So saying that the reasoning that says in order to protect, and it's usually the authorities, we disarm the population. He's saying, no, actually, it's easier for the few to go wrong than the majority. So it's just another argument he has against the gun issue, which I'm sure nobody in this room is new to them. It's interesting now, question 37, he's dealing with an issue that he's asking whether the estates of Scotland could lawfully help the oppressed brethren in England, both the Parliament and the Protestants. And I'm not sure what kind of political connection, what kind of tie there was. You know, you had the one piece of land and you had this history of swapping and changing out who was in charge and one head over all, and we want to be separate and we want to be joined. And so I'm not sure exactly what the exact dynamics were in his day. So in that sense, I'm ignorant. But anyway, he's asking, what is our responsibility as Scotland to help the English if they're being slaughtered by the Roman Catholic Church? It seems his position was that the Scottish were bound to help their brethren and the cause of true religion. And he quotes Proverbs 24:11-12. Deliver those who are drawn towards death and hold back those stumbling to the slaughter. If I say, surely we did not know this, does not he who weighs the hearts consider it? He who keeps your souls, does he not know it? And will he not render to each man according to his deeds? And so, and Rutherford then says, Ambrose, he cited this text when he commended Moses, who killed the Egyptian in defending the Hebrew man when he slew the Egyptian who was persecuting the Hebrew. And he says, to deliver is an act of charity, and so to be done, though the judge forbid it, when the innocent is unjustly put to death. So in the same context of the unjust authority in England sentencing a just Protestant to death, Rutherford's opponents objected to his position, saying, okay, so you're going to go and help your Protestant brother that the Roman Catholic king has rightly put to death. You're saying you're going to go and help him. And I'm not sure at this point where Rutherford is using the estates of Scotland and where the individual is used, because it seems there's kind of a switching between these, and I'm not quite sure where the lines are. But we can just ponder what he's got to say and come up with our own idea of where we think the line should be. But his opponent said, if you think that it's right for you guys to go and help this guy who's being unlawfully persecuted, they're saying, but in doing so, private men may offer violence to the lawful magistrate when he unjustly puts an innocent man to death and rescues him out of the hands of the magistrate. And this were to bring in anarchy and confusion. But if it be an act of charity to deliver the innocent out of the hands of the magistrate. So they're saying this is going to be chaos if you say this is allowed to happen. And that's why I'm wondering, because his opponents then say, if an individual can do this, go and rescue another individual. I'm wondering, that's why I'm confused as to what Rutherford really intends. So how you could help the oppressed. I believe you could go and help anybody. Any one of us in this room could go and help any nation, any people, any cause. Obviously you want to make sure it's just and honorable and godly, but as a private person, that's within your jurisdiction. My understanding is always that for a nation to actually send their troops to help another nation, there has to be something extenuating. I don't believe it's something you should do, but I'm going to raise a possible extenuating circumstance later, and that's why I'm saying extenuating. So Rutherford responds to this claim of anarchy by saying that the whole matter requires wisdom and the right circumstances that help indicate what ought to be done. He says, the law of nature telleth us to obedience in acts of charity, yet not to perform these acts after any way and in any manner, in a mere natural way. We don't just do it in any way we want. But I am to perform acts of natural charity in a rational and prudent way, and in looking to God's law. Else, if my brother or father were justly condemned to die, I might violently deliver them out of the magistrate's hand. Okay, so they might be justly sentenced, and yet I'm going to war. So obviously that would not be allowed. But on the contrary, my hand should be first on him without natural compassion. If that was the case, then I should be against my father and my brother as well. As if my brother or my wife have been blasphemers of God, therefore I am to act naturally as a wife, as a wise man observing, as Solomon saith in Ecclesiastes 8:5, both time and judgment, observing these things. So I'm responsible. As parents were responsible to put to death their rebellious children, so he's saying, yes, I should be involved in that. Now it were no wisdom for a private man to hazard his own life by attempting to rescue an innocent brother, because he hath not strength to do it. So he's saying if you've got a brother in the Tower of London, he's about to be executed, and you one man, you're going to go and try and rescue him, no matter how innocent he is, he says that's foolish. He says it's not conducive to wisdom, it's not conducive to even the remotest chance of success. You have no strength to do it, and the law of nature obligeth me not to acts of charity when I in all reason see them impossible. But a multitude who has strength did well to rescue innocent Jonathan out of the hands of the king, that he should not be put to death. Yet one man was not tied by the law of nature to rescue Jonathan if the king and prince had condemned him, though unjustly. So you remember the case with Jonathan and his father when he forbid them from eating honey. Rutherford says, the children of God and of Reuben and the half tribe of Manasseh, though their inheritance fell on the other side of the Jordan, yet they were to go over the river armed to fight for their brethren, while they had also possession of the land at the commandment of Moses and Joshua. He cites Numbers and Joshua for this. So I'm not sure Rutherford is using this as an illustration of those coming to help. Either Rutherford is making a mistake and assuming the tribes and regarding them as independent nations, unlike the United States, you know, saying like, for example, regarding each state as an independent nation. And so if one state was helping another, he's saying, well, that's like one nation helping another at this stage. Remember he's talking about Scotland and England? And now he's talking about these tribes coming across the Jordan to help these. So he's either making a mistake with respect to treating the tribes as independent nations, and therefore, because the tribes helped another tribe, therefore a nation can help another nation. Either that's the case there, or he's seeing some closer connection between Scotland and England that I'm unaware of. But again, he says, if the communion of saints be any bond that England and we have, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one head and Savior, Jesus Christ, then are we obliged to help our bleeding sister church against those same common enemies, papists and prelates? And then he says, Queen Elizabeth helped Holland against the King of Spain, and besides the union in religion, we sail in one ship together, being in one island, under one king, and now, by the mercy of God, have sworn one covenant, and so must stand or fall together. So that's why I'm unsure of the relationship that existed. We are obliged, rather, it says, by the union betwixt the kingdoms, concluded to by the Convention of the Estates of Scotland in 1585, at the desire of the General Assembly of 1583, to join forces together at home and enter into league with Protestant princes and estates abroad to maintain the Protestant religion against the bloody Confederacy of Trent. And accordingly, this league between the two crowns was subscribed at Berwick in 1586, and the same renewed in 1587 and 88, as also the Confession of Faith subscribed when the Spanish Armada was on our coasts. What he's seeing here is the massive Roman Catholic threat, which was basically a world-conquering objective. And so his argument is, we can agree or disagree, but we can discuss it. His argument is, in those circumstances, we have a mutual threat, we have a mutual enemy who's threatening us all. And so he continues his argument. He says, when papists in arms had undone England, if God gave them victory, they should next fall on us, and it should not be in the king's power at that time to resist them. When our enemies within 2 days' journey are in arms and have the person of our king and his judgment, and so the breathing law of the two kingdoms under their power, we should but sleep to be killed in our nest if we did not arise and fight for king, for country, for church and brethren. So his argument there is, when it's imminent that the common enemy is on your border, I mean, fighting your neighbor and crushing it, and his next step is you, how do we respond? Do we go in with the common fight? You know, how the whole ISIS thing is going to play out and how that's going to unfold, we've got to be wrestling with that issue as well. How do we do that? I don't believe America should go and help Kuwait, for example, because they're getting overrun by a bully. I don't see that as a moral obligation, unless you could directly prove that Kuwait was this, you know, it was this natural stepping stone to America. And so you're saying, well, I'm going to stop you as far away as possible. So, you know, obviously, preemptive strikes are necessary, and this is a form of preemptive strike, I believe, what he's talking about. If England is being overrun by the Spanish, should Scotland go to England's aid? Because once the Spanish take England, they're going to be coming up to Scotland. They're not stopping. So that's the debate. And so that is an important issue that we need to wrestle with. And finally for us tonight, Rutherford says, the law of gratitude obliges us to see this. England sent an army to free both our souls and our bodies from the bondage of popery and the fury of the French, upon which occasion a parliament at Leith around 1560 established peace and religion, and then after they helped us against a faction of papists in our own bosom, for which sake we take God's name in prayer, seeking grace never to forget that kindness. So whether that obliges you to help somebody because they helped you, or not. That's kind of the thrust of Place for Resistance, and then trying to deal practically with things that actually maybe 5 years ago might not have been as relevant, that suddenly loom high and mighty on the horizon for us. So hopefully it lends some kind of help to our thinking.